This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to a big show for the new decade. From Yale, Narasimha Rao says basic quality of life for all humans does not require a new burst of carbon into the atmosphere. Brilliant young scientist Zhengzhong Zeng says growing wind is a bonus for wind power. Plus, he has startling green news from China. Heather McTier-Tony joins us on the 100% Clean Economy Act and mothers stepping out on climate change. There is no time to waste. 1 in 7 people on this planet live in extreme poverty right now. They will need plenty of carbon to develop before they can buy anything like electric cars or solar panels. But what if I told you billions of people could get enough food, health care, and education without adding a single new power station, without an increase in national emissions? Experts who looked into it say it could be done. Energy Requirements for Decent Living in India, Brazil, and South Africa is the title of a new study published in the journal Nature Energy. We reached the lead author, Dr. Narasimha Rao, Assistant Professor of Energy Systems at the School of Forestry and Environment Studies at Yale University. He is also affiliated with the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Laxenburg, Austria. From Massachusetts, Narasimha Rao, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
In a 2018 paper, you wrote, more than 60 million homes in India are unfit for decent living. Replacing this stock with decent housing will entail significant costs and increased energy consumption and related CO2 emissions. Can we house those millions of people in India without a dangerous new load of greenhouse gas emissions?
And so, yes, it is possible to fill the housing gap in India, which is about 50 to 60 million, either slums or substandard units, without a significant impact on climate. And let me explain why I say that. If we just put this into the context of energy demand in the globe, we think about the average in industrialized countries to be about 65 gigajoules per person. That's a unit of energy. In comparison to that, we have found that in India, we would require on the order of 12 to 17 gigajoules per capita to provide the entire basket of basic living standards, including housing, transport, and several other amenities. And that is well within the energy consumption today in India per person. So we've also found in this research that through better construction practices that use local materials, the extent of that increase would be even less and potentially even cost-saving. And we found this to be the case as well in Brazil and South Africa, which have much smaller gaps. But in general, the point is that we found out for the first time that the amount of energy that we require for these basic living standards are not a significant increase and just almost a rounding error with respect to the amount of energy that's consumed in industrialized countries today.
And in an earlier paper, you found out that something called stabilized earth blocks as a local construction tool can save a lot of energy. Can you just take a couple of seconds to tell us what that is?
Yeah, it's instead of the traditional reinforced concrete blocks that are used in multi-story buildings, this is a variant of that is made from a local earth, but it's reinforced and cured to be solid and durable. It's therefore called a stabilized earth block. And we found it can reduce energy use for its construction by about 20% compared to the conventional technology or compared to masonry for building homes, which is the norm for India right now.
I've traveled up and down India by train, and it all works. What about Brazil, though, and its transport system? Are there different problems to look at there?
The main problem from a development perspective is that in rural areas, the roads are of very poor quality. But in general, the standard of living in Brazil is much higher than that of India, and it's a very car-dependent economy. Almost the entire transportation system is based on cars and buses and not much rail, which is in stark contrast to India. So the impact of that on climate change is that the energy intensity, that means the amount of energy you need per unit of transport traveled, is much higher in a car-dependent economy than in one that has a lot of public transit. So if you compare India and Brazil for the same amount of mobility that we have assumed as a basic minimum, you find that Brazilians are consuming significantly more energy because they achieve that mobility requirement with cars, whereas it's a mix of different modes of public transport in India. So there isn't exactly much of a development problem except for the poor quality roads, but it is a more significant impact on climate. If Brazilians were to, for example, install dedicated bus lanes and encourage greater use of buses on those roads, that could actually reduce energy use quite significantly.
Is there still a serious poverty problem in Brazil?
Sure. I mean, Brazil is a fairly unequal society, and you have a large number of slums or favelas, and the living conditions aren't always acceptable from the perspective of what we found to be a basic living standard. So the income in Brazil is maybe about $10,000 to $11,000 per capita U.S., but still you find a lot of homes. We found, I think, a gap of about 5 million homes that are substandard in Brazil. And you also have some that don't have adequate sanitation facilities. So they would have most of the other amenities that we include in the living standard. And probably in the next 20 years or so, there wouldn't be much of a gap left. But we did find in housing and sanitation that there is a gap.
Well, sure, we should talk about what do you define as a decent living standard. I mean, it's going to be different for someone in Canada. I might think I'm really quite poor because I'm on what we call welfare here or something like that. But I would be rich compared to many people, millions of people in the countries that you studied. What is a decent standard of living?
Right, yeah, that's an important question. And we have tried to be more comprehensive than other poverty indicators thus far. There have been multidimensional poverty indicators that try to make more transparent the deprivations people experience rather than just speaking of an income poverty, which tends to be very context-dependent. And we've drawn from actually ethical theories and social policies about what would be a universal standard of human well-being in a more abstract sense. And then we think about what is the material basis for that basic human well-being. It's not sufficient to ensure people have well-being, but it would be an essential requirement. And that's what we define as this decent living standards. And it includes some of the more conventional requirements that people would understand, such as food, water, clean sanitation, a shelter. But we also include things like mobility, having access to motorized transport of some kind, because that increases the options that you have for livelihood and for getting to a hospital and school, for example. And then we include health and education, of course, and having health care accessible. And probably one aspect that is much more characteristic of the modern society is that we also find from theory that people want very much to have social affiliation, to be part of community. And we have thought about the material enablers of that in modern society. And so we include things like access to the internet and having a cell phone and having some device at home that allows you to access the internet. And those end up being quite trivial in terms of energy requirement, but they are an important part of the basket. And then refrigerators in the home as well, and electricity access so you can have lighting. These are all the fundamental elements. We also have a twist on the existing elements that are known in policy, such as food. We don't think of food as just calories, but we think of adequate nutrition, which might have a very different implication for the appropriate diets that people have, and also makes us cognizant of things like overconsumption and obesity that result from too many calories.
Yeah, I was surprised from your study how affordable the really important things like education and like health care and even food can be compared to what you call mobility, getting around by cars mainly or by trucks and all the things that are trucked in, so that we could at least institute those things that make life worth living without blowing up the carbon.
Yes, absolutely. And just to be clear, when you say affordable, we've done this analysis really only in terms of energy, not in terms of money. But yes, providing health care and education and even some basic amenities like conditioning your home to comfortable temperatures turns out to be quite trivial. And that was an insight of our study. And perhaps to provide some insight to listeners as to why that is the case, if you think about healthcare and education, you tend to have these are shared facilities. A lot of, you know, thousands or hundreds of people use these individual facilities. So when you think about their material requirements per person, it ends up being much, much less than when you think about things like your home, which every household would be expected to have. So, yeah, it was a very important insight that some of the most important basic social services that we ought to provide people, basic healthcare, education, a safe home, is not a major impact. Really, it's the very large homes and very energy-intensive modes of transport are really the biggest areas that we can potentially make a big impact on climate or potentially save if we are more modest in our requirements and our lifestyles.
Why did you pick South Africa as the third case study about the climate cost of getting out of poverty?
Well, I mean, we wanted to do many more countries than just three, but we had the resources for just a handful, and we wanted to pick countries that were, first of all, in different regions where there are many countries with a lot of poverty. And so we wanted at least one important country in each of the continents where you see poverty. So one in South America, Brazil, one in South Asia, India, and in Sub-Saharan Africa. We chose South Africa. It also is a country that is highly unequal, but has a fairly decent, it's a middle-income country. And there's also data available. So that's many reasons led us to choose that country. We do plan to scale this up to other countries now that we've done these pilot studies, and countries such as Nigeria, for example, or Indonesia, China, are all extremely important to find patterns across the developing world so we can actually make some statements about poverty eradication globally and its impact on climate change.
I've spoken with a couple of energy experts from India, and they seem to say the new coal plants in construction and planned there will not provide power for the 600 million Indians still without electricity. It's more for air conditioners and goods for the middle class, mostly living in big cities. So it's hard to get that dynamic where we actually do apply the carbon budget that's left to the people that need it most.
Yes, indeed. This is another important insight from the study. I mean, this is largely an equity issue. It's a justice issue. It's a matter of allocating resources where they're needed most. And that applies both within these countries, such as the example you gave, that from our study, we find that the bulk of energy used today is really supporting a middle class and affluent lifestyle more than it is serving the most basic needs of people. And so that, you know, that change in a more in a direction of more equitable distribution would in fact have a positive effect on climate. But the same thing applies across countries. If you think about the extent to which we in the industrialized countries are consuming energy well above what is required for a basic living standard, and that if you had things like access to better technologies, affordable clean technologies in developing countries that are not even yet making a big dent in the industrialized countries. If you do have access to those affordable technologies, you could also potentially even lower the amount of emissions you need even just to meet those basic living standards. And that's another point that's important to understand, is that in the international efforts to try and reduce carbon, we need to think about equity across countries as well.
Did I understand you correctly that you were saying that to provide a decent standard of living in these very populous countries, we don't need to add more energy than they already currently produce? That seems unbelievable. Did I get it right?
Well, I wouldn't put it exactly like that. What we found was, if we look at the total amount of energy hypothetically one would need to provide everybody with the basic living standard in those countries, yes, it is well within the amount of energy demand today that is being used in society, which primarily goes to serve the middle class and affluent parts of the society. However, it is probably not realistic to expect that these countries can all of a sudden transform to direct all future energy use to only to the poor and their needs. And so there's always been inequality in societies, and one would expect that you can perhaps expect some direction of change towards more equitable development, but the main point is to indicate that there doesn't have to be significant growth well beyond what they currently consume, but we need to just be cognizant of the fact that there needs to be more equitable distribution in the future so that future growth can serve those basic needs as a priority.
I'm struck by echoes of your work in things like the Voluntary Simplicity Movement or Transition Towns. There are some people in the West who are trying to use less in order to make that margin that others will need to get their decent standard of living. Do you see a parallel there?
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly the kind of movements we need in the industrialized countries. Tiny homes and in other communities, like the fire community, and there are many communities that are looking to live sustainably using only local resources. And that's exactly the way you put it, is the way we need to think about it. In some ways, if we want to achieve our most ambitious goals for climate mitigation, there's sort of a zero-sum game at play here globally. And the extent to which, you know, we can discipline our consumption, you know, we do create that room for achieving living standards in other countries. And I might add that I think that that can happen in a manner that does not really hurt our well-being as much as perhaps the current perception suggests.
I think that the harshest people are secretly thinking inside themselves, well, if we have no remaining carbon budget, perhaps it's best if the people who are poor stay in their local villages without transportation and live from local lands if they can, so that we can go on living the way that we're living. But that kind of injustice just isn't going to make it in a world where everyone can communicate and see how each of us is living. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I have two thoughts I might express. One of them is, you know, developing countries are not going to do that. They're going to want to grow and afford the inhabitants a certain lifestyle. And so what will happen if the industrialized countries don't lead by developing the technologies we need or by reducing consumption, the developing countries will just blow through, you know, the energy growth, and then we will just not meet those ambitious targets. I don't expect that those developing countries are going to all of a sudden stop meeting those basic needs. So that's one aspect of it. And I certainly feel that this has some practical implication, because if you think about the Sustainable Development Goals that were promulgated in 2015, one of them is to provide energy access globally to people, access to electricity and access to clean cooking. You know, there is, in some portions of those efforts, thinking about providing electricity access to people with, you know, lighting and phone charging using solar home systems and other types of configurations. And it's important to think that lighting and phone charging is only the start, and that as they develop further, you need to support a longer-term sustainable, you know, energy infrastructure for these people, and not just think about energy access in terms of just a light bulb and a phone charge. So, yeah, I think that's a very relevant point, that we understand the growth that's required, and really for people in the industrialized countries to understand how globally interconnected we are in terms of our material use and the impact on the environment.
So when government representatives and experts meet at the conference of the parties in the climate summits, how can they draw on your new work?
Right. There are three aspects that need to be discussed typically in these negotiations. One is mitigation, that is trying to take stock of where we are with regards to all of the country's nationally determined contributions, and then make the next set of pledges, which are expected to be more ambitious. There's adaptation, which is dealing with the impacts of climate change. And third, there is the means of implementation. And that's where I think that this work may have some practical significance, which is we can now perhaps evaluate and assess countries' intended contributions or intended actions to mitigate climate change using this one lens as an input. That is, to what extent are these efforts targeted towards the poor? To what extent are the needs, those basic living standards, being protected? And perhaps we can have now a basis to look at the comparability of different countries' efforts by looking at the extent to which they relate to these basic living standards. So I think that's one way we can take that into account. I think in the slightly longer term, when we have more research for the global implications of poverty eradication, I think this just provides some teeth to these concerns about common but differentiated responsibility, which is kind of the underpinning of the climate agreement, is that we find a way to provide developing countries with equitable access to development in some ways that they can protect their development needs. And now I think we have perhaps one way to actually quantify those development needs in terms of energy. And that is very useful, because it provides a concrete way to assess the extent to which countries' mitigation actions are impinging on these basic needs.
What drives you personally to do the research you do?
Well, it's primarily a sense of justice. It's a desire to pursue justice in our development. But the other aspect I might add is that this problem is a very complex problem. It involves the use of many disciplines. It involves drawing from economics, drawing from engineering and energy systems, but also drawing from ethics and morality. And I think this makes it very difficult to generate problem solutions that are practical and ethically driven and understandable to people. And so I really felt that I had something to offer in terms of developing sort of practical solutions, what I call practical ethics, actual solutions that are driven by sound moral principles. And I felt my skills lent themselves to that. And so that's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
And as we finish up, what are you working on next?
Well, there's many research directions that stem from this particular work itself. As I mentioned, we're trying to scale this up for the whole developing world. What are the energy needs across all different kinds of countries? And then one might think about other resource requirements that could constrain our development. So if we use this basic living standard as a foundation, we might think about to what extent are we constrained in terms of cement or water, other resources, rare minerals that may be coming from very particular countries in the world. And so I would like to develop a broader characterization of some of the resource implications of poverty eradication more broadly beyond just climate change, because I think we're facing many other types of environmental impacts and constraints as well. So that's an important part of my work. I'm also thinking a lot about ways that developing countries can both adapt to the impacts of climate change as well as mitigate climate change. And housing is a very important example of that, where building better homes for poor people can reduce energy use compared to what they would otherwise, as well as make their homes more resilient to heat stress and other types of climate impacts.
We've been speaking with Dr. Narasimha Rao. He leads the new paper, Energy Requirements for Decent Living in India, Brazil, and South Africa. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In a wave of bad news about climate change, some changes are good. We all cheer on wind power, for example. Unfortunately, for a decade or so, wind speeds were dropping around the world. But new science shows that general calming has reversed itself. In a boon to wind farms, a typical wind turbine is producing about 17% more energy today than in 2010. So there's a new wind blowing. A team of 15 authors published this paper in Nature Climate Change. It's titled A Reversal in Global Terrestrial Stilling and Its Implications for Wind Energy Production. We talk with the lead author, Dr. Zhenxiang Zheng, and he is a postdoctoral scholar at Princeton, currently in China. From Shenzhen, China, Zhenxiang Zheng, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me here.
I've never heard of Shenzhen. Where is it, and what is it like there?
Actually, I have to correct that. I'm not a postdoc now. I am now an associate professor at the Southern University of Science and Technology.
And where is that located?
It's in Shenzhen, a city near Hong Kong. I think this is the youngest city all around the world. Only 30 years, the GDP has overpassed Hong Kong.
Wow. Now that's saying something. And mostly new buildings then?
Yeah. And the high-rise building, more than 600 meters high, and a lot.
That is very tall indeed. And what are you doing in China?
I'm doing research and advising students here. And now, because I'm an associate professor here, I have to search for funding, teach students, and do research.
All right. Now, could you please explain for us what global terrestrial stilling is?
Well, it is a phenomenon that the observed land surface wind speed has declined since around 1960s. And over the past 50 years, the average land wind speed has declined by around 50%. And if this trend continues to the end of this century, the wind speed will decrease by around 21%, and the wind power will drop by 50%. That's a lot.
That would be tremendous. And do we know why the Earth's winds were slowing down since the 1960s?
Before that, we had one hypothesis. That is the greening of the Earth. the vegetation is growing better, and that increases the surface roughness, and then will drag the wind speed and slow down the wind. But now our findings show that they are wrong.
Yes, and we'll talk a little bit later about some of the greening that's happening in China. I wonder, though, if a gradual slowing of Earth's winds was accepted and observed for so long, what led you and your 14 co-authors to question that?
Okay, as I mentioned before, last year I did a research about the relation between the greening and the terrestrial steering. We used fancy Earth system models to simulate how the greening of the Earth will impact the land surface wind speed. But we found that it's wrong. Yeah. The greening of the Earth will not cause the terrestrial steering, and we reject the hypothesis. And last year, we also put forward another hypothesis, that is the greening, the urbanization, but we also rejected that hypothesis. And then we update our data set. Very surprisingly, we found that the terrestrial steering has reversed around 2010. You know that before that, in around 2013, all scientists will not update their data set. They only use data before 2010, so they did not observe the reversal. We are very surprised about that. And then for our curiosity, then we began this research.
You know, this is a major change. Something has changed fundamentally, and I didn't know about it. I don't think the public knows about it, but I guess it's a good thing for wind farms.
Yes, it's very good.
So is there a relationship between changes in the ocean and the amount of wind that we get?
Over ocean, it is obviously yes, but over land, it's not certain. But now our finding shows that there is a strong relationship between the changes in ocean and the wind speed over land. And we have to, because now the phenomenon has fundamentally changed, many theories and the projections about the steering are waiting update.
When we talk about oceans affecting the atmosphere above, frankly, it's hard to picture how that's even possible if you're not a scientist. How can the sea change what is happening in the air far above it?
The overall change is not important. For example, if you only mention global warming, that's not important. The key is that some regions warm faster than the other regions, and that will create temperature gradient, and then air pressure gradient, and then drive the fluctuations that will impact the climate over land.
So if the wind is good news for wind farms, does that increase also suggest even more violent storms could happen?
That's possible, but we need more research to figure out whether hurricanes have increased. But from our study, we have found that the wind speed increased during all the four seasons, not only the hurricane season. And the increase of wind speed during the recent decade is more in regular wind speed level than that in maximum wind speed. So the recent increase of wind speed is good news for wind farms.
And is this increase we're talking about happening everywhere or just in some regions or in certain bands around the Earth? What's the geography of it?
It is mainly happening in mid-latitude countries such as United States, Canada, China, and the European countries. And most wind turbines were installed in these countries. But in some locations, for example, some cities are occurring very fast urbanization. Wind speed may have decreased. But that is very local scale.
Were you able to find hard statistics showing power generation from certain wind turbines or wind farms actually has gone up?
No, I did not get this data. You know, it is very difficult to get data from particular wind turbines. We have to know those people. But we collect data from the whole United States, and we find that the total wind power production from all the turbines in the United States during 2009 to 2017. And we found very good relationship between their production and the cube of the wind speed in the United States.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock from China. I'm speaking with Dr. Zheng Zhongzheng with some good news about wind power. But how do we know that increase in electricity from wind is not just due to building bigger turbines or better technology?
Oh, because in my situation, I control wind turbines and only change wind speed. So the result we find is only from the increase of the wind speed, not because of the wind turbine.
Do we know whether the increase in global wind in recent years will continue, and if so, for how long?
As you can see from our recent paper, we found that ocean atmosphere oscillations are the key. But you know that is the Earth system that is very complex, but it has some rules. So given it is long size circles, we predict that the current trend will last for maybe one decade, at least one decade. But that is long enough for lifespan of wind turbines. Normally, they will not live for more than 20 years. But maybe after 10 years or 20 years, it will drop down again. So we need to continue to do more research in this field.
Indeed. So in past years, you have been co-author in a series of papers about the role of vegetation to moderate climate in China. How does vegetation play an important role there?
First, vegetation plays an important role not only in China. Actually, it is all around the world. We published a paper in Natural Climate Change to show that the greening of the earth I think that paper was published in 2017. And then we continue to find that because of the greening of the earth, the vegetation has helped we human beings to slow down the global warming by 12%. And we also find that the greening has intensified the terrestrial water cycle. For example, 30% of the increase of precipitation during the past 30 years overland is caused by the greening of the earth. And 50% of the increase of evapotranspiration is caused by the greening. And we know that the greening in China and India dominates the greening of the earth.
That is so interesting. So just to be clear, did you say that the greening of the earth has slowed down global warming by 12% or has actually cooled the earth by 12%?
It slowed down. That is to say, if the vegetation do not help us, our warming rate will be 12% faster than the current warming rate.
So I would take from that, if we had an expansion of deserts and dry areas, changes to the rainfall cycle, which have been projected in many climate maps, that might reintroduce the heating that has been, let's say, masked or hidden, or at least handled somehow, by the greening that you've been talking about.
You mean if we expand desert, what will our climate change, right?
Yes, and we would lose again, though, the benefit that we've had from this greening. If the greening were to reverse itself, the heating would reappear.
Yeah, and our planet will be much warmer and dry. There will be more drought events and heat.
I had been reading about growing deserts in China, especially in the north of China, and there is a great battle on by the government and by the people to combat that. But how can there be a greening trend in the country at the same time?
There are several aspects happening here. For one, in northern part, because of the warming, the temperature is better. And if we do not cut the tree may grow better. And for the other region, you know, China is the largest afforestation country. Only until 2008, around 62 million hectares have been afforested in China. That is around 23% of global plantation area. But now the problem is where we should plant our trees. In southern China, southeastern China, this area is good for trees, and if we plant trees there, they will grow very well. But if we plant trees in desert area or in very dry western China, and maybe also northern China, northwestern China, that is very dry and that is not suitable for trees. If you plant more trees there, they will not survive. They will die. They will pump more water from the ground. The groundwater will decrease, and that will actually will get more desert will expand in those regions. So that's the reason why you can hear why since overall it is greening in China, but you can still see some news that in some areas deserts are increasing.
I have seen an increase in the number of really interesting research papers published in English language journals by Chinese authors. And I'm wondering, is the study of climate growing in China? And if so, why do you think that is?
Oh, yes. It's increasing very fast during the recent year, maybe the past decade since the meet between President Obama and President Hu Jintao, and more, maybe even several years before than that. And then our government and also our president and the prime minister, they highlight a lot of the ecological civilization. And as a result, they put a lot of funding for us. So our money increased a lot. Take me, for example, my school give me $1.5 million for my startup. That's very good. And I cannot get this kind of number all around the world. I think only in China.
And you'll set up a small institute with that? Is that the plan?
Only for my group.
Right. Like a lab, it would be called in the West.
Yeah, my lab. And I hire 10 students now, just 2 months.
Wow. Okay. Now, there must also then be a pool of climate knowledge developed in China, but perhaps not yet translated to other languages?
I'm not sure. You know, I went to Princeton since 2016. I just graduated from Peking University, and then I spent three years in Princeton, and I had not returned China, and I had not focused on in Chinese journals since then. I only focused on English journals since then. So I'm not familiar with the Chinese journals and the knowledge in China, in Chinese language.
Well, I think English has been accepted for now as an international language of science, but I still do worry that there's really good work, for example, going on in Germany that's published in German and doesn't make it out to the rest of us in English.
But I don't think this is the same in China because our government and our school encourage us to use English. And you know, in my university, it's in Shenzhen, and our official language is English. We teach our students by English, and we talk with them sometimes by English.
Do you see yourself with a direction in your scientific work? Are you developing one specialty, or do you work on several problems these days?
And I also find that because of the increase of the wind speed, before that, we think that the sandstorm, you know, and the main air pollution problem are driven by wind speed. But now we find that wind speed has increased, but sandstorm in China has not increased. So I'm very curious about that. Why? Our theory before is wrong. Now I will more focus on this question. Why? What drives the sandstorm in China in last 60 decades?
Oh, the sandstorms.
Well, that's a big problem in China if you have been to Beijing,
yes,
10 years ago. But now it disappears.
Even though the wind has increased.
We don't know why. My theory is that the decrease of the sandstorm is because of the terrestrial steering, the decrease of wind speed. But we find that now wind speed has increased, but sandstorm disappear, still not show up. So what happened? We don't know yet.
That is definitely worth looking into. I'm hoping that it has stopped. That's better for the people of Beijing, for sure. So on your new paper about increased wind power, I wonder how this news can reach the governments or the policy planners or even the banks who are considering investing in wind power. Do you think they already know about this just by looking at better production figures?
I think they do not know yet. And now, so I thank you and many other media, for example, BBC and NPR, for helping us to deliver this knowledge to them. I think this will be very helpful for them.
Are you personally a fan of alternative energy?
Of course. That is the only way we can replace fossil fuel and save our planet.
I totally agree. We have been speaking with Dr. Shenxiang Zhang, lead author of the paper, A Reversal in Global Terrestrial Stilling and Its Implications for Wind Energy Production. And we've been talking about China in general. So you can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Shenxiang, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you for having me here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I have lots more for you on the startling science presented in this interview with Shenxiang Zhang. Be sure to check my show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org for more discussion on the points he raised. Next, America tries to get its climate act together. If we want to stay in a climate that is kind to us, we have to stop filling the atmosphere with more carbon than nature can absorb. Imagine America taking up that vision. The American Congress has a bill for it. It's called the 100% Clean Economy Act. This new legislation has widespread support from groups like the Environmental Defense Fund and even business. To help us understand that vision, we have one of the bright lights, Heather McTeer-Tony. Now, from 2004 to 2012, Heather served as mayor of Greenville, Mississippi. She was the first African-American and first woman to hold that position. President Obama appointed Heather as regional administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency's Southeast region. That's a huge job with a budget of around $500 million. Now Heather is field director for the nonprofit group Moms Clean Air Force. Heather McTeer-Tony, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I hate to start off on a dark note, but I worry people are so close to despair that they think any legislation is flawed and doomed and not going anywhere. Who is putting forward the 100% Clean Economy Act?
Well, to address that issue of hope and despair, I would challenge anyone, just look in the eyes of a child. That's where I get my inspiration. Anytime I look at my kids, I know exactly why I'm doing this work, and I am so appreciative to the members of Congress that put forth the 100% Clean Economy Act, because I do think they have our children in mind. And so Congressman Donald McEachin from Virginia, Deb Haaland, Debbie Dingell, Paul Tonko, among a number of others, really came together to pull a piece of legislation that I believe really moves to protect the public health and the environment and create the clean energy economy and really strengthening our economy for the sake of our nation and for our entire planet. And I'm hopeful with that.
There still are a lot of surprises coming out as new science rolls out. It seems every new paper in the leading journals documents how we grossly underestimated the threat and the time we have to fix things. Can't we really wait until 2050 to stop polluting the atmosphere?
Moms across this country, certainly our membership and parents everywhere, say that we've got to do this as soon as possible. But I'm really hopeful, and I think that this bill does a good job of allowing the agencies to not only look at how they can achieve this goal. You know, one of the very unfortunate things that has happened over the past 4 years has been the reduction of scientists and technology experts within agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Energy. It's been saddening to see that a number of the advisory boards, for example, have really been decimated, and that we've lost a lot of institutional knowledge with respect to science and technology on climate issues. However, this bill is written in with the idea in mind of us rebuilding that science and technology base and hopefully bringing some of that back such that they can make plans and look at how we can achieve this goal hopefully faster than 2050. The other thing that the bill does is it allows the agencies to set an interim near-term emission reduction goal so that makes sure that we're on track for 2050. So we're not looking at a situation where we're waiting to 2048 to say, okay, now we need to get it done. There are opportunities throughout the bill for agencies to work together and to bring in communities and ensure that we're doing this in a very fair and equitable fashion.
Well, you've given me a little hope that we could rebuild America as a leading science pool by, you know, within a year after the elections, it's possible. But in the meantime, I know what my listeners are thinking. Well, Mitch McConnell's going to kill off any 100% clean economy bill. What is the current status of the 100% Clean Economy Act?
So it is going to be moving towards, or we hope it's moving towards a vote. I know there's a lot of things that are happening in Washington, D.C. right now that may have the attention of our legislators, but I am hopeful that people and citizens in district will keep this at the forefront and ask their legislators as they're home for the holidays and even when they return back, what are you doing on the 100% Clean Economy Act? Are you pushing this forward? And are we going to make sure that we get this passed? I'm hopeful that it will get passed. But there's also, you know, what's going on in local communities. So I don't want to have your listeners thinking that it's completely hopeless, because it is not. But also, it's great to talk about in your local communities, because we are seeing state legislators, governors, mayors across this country take bold action on climate, even when our federal government is not. So organizations like Climate Mayors and C40 mayors are saying that we are going to stand up and ensure that we have climate action now, and are even utilizing and looking at some of the same things that are within this bill, some of the same guiding principles that we have for action, and using some of these same bases to make sure that they're doing it within their own local communities and in their states. They just need to hear from your listeners, and they need to hear from the people.
Well, you're spot on with that. We just had a guest, Rana Adib, on our program talking from Paris about all the cities around the world who, when national governments say we're out, they're saying we're in. And so there's a lot of hope there. So this act may inspire that.
There's also, though, the focus on equity and justice and ensuring that there is fairness in these environmental outcomes for rural and low-income communities, as well as communities that may have been disproportionately impacted by climate, vulnerable populations that we really haven't heard from before. This particular piece of legislation ensures that having that conversation is a guiding principle for that action, and that we're talking about not only making sure that they are positively impacted, but that we're providing benefits. So we're talking job creation when we are talking about 100% clean energy. We're talking about equitable transition for workers who would be affected by any type of change in the economy. We're talking about preparing communities for things like climate impacts and risks that are associated with climate change and how they can use clean energy to really bolster their economy. So this is a holistic bill and approach to addressing climate, and a good step in the right direction for how our country should be addressing this issue.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. For me, one of the frightening moments in American history was Hurricane Katrina, when the hot Gulf waters and the high seas just got that storm going. And African Americans were the most traumatized by it all. So many had to migrate. They were the first, I think, climate migrants in the United States, going to Denver and Nashville and all over the country. And so I'm hoping we can make our response a lot better when the next climate-powered disaster strikes. Will this bill help that, or do you see other things that will help make our response better?
You made a key point of when. It's never if, it's always when. And this bill absolutely looks to how we can use these actions to prepare communities for climate impacts and prepare for resiliency and sustainability. I was in Houston, Texas a few weeks ago, and we have a great organizer there who herself came from Katrina and moved to Houston as a result. And even after moving to Houston, was impacted by two hurricanes there in the Houston area. So the issues of how these impact all of our communities, but particularly communities of color and those that are in vulnerable places geographically across this country, is very important to how this bill is implemented. And I think is at the high point of how agencies will look at their actions. So taking infrastructure, for example, a way that agencies will look at how they can implement 100% clean energy to ensure that the infrastructure itself is sustainable and very resilient using wind and solar. Power grids are able to be back online in all communities as a result of any type of extreme weather event. These are things that are important to citizens, to mayors, to state legislators, to businesses, and most certainly to our parents and moms and members of Moms Clean Air Force. Because I tell you, if you have a child with asthma or maybe an elderly parent who's on an oxygen machine, you don't care how the electricity gets back on. You want it on, and you want it on now. These are the types of situations that this bill would be able and looking to address.
Well, right. We've heard the raging grannies sing, and we've certainly seen youth, including Greta Thunberg. But I've wondered for years, where are the mothers, the people who care most about a safe future for their kids? So, Heather McTeer, Tony, why don't you tell us about Moms Clean Air Force?
So moms are always there. We are ever present. Even I think of moms like the wind. You don't see it, but you feel it. And that's exactly what Moms Clean Air Force and our membership of almost a million members across this country, that's who and what we are. We are the force behind our children that are out there protesting and are taking off their Fridays to come and talk about climate action. We're caring for our elderly parents who are also impacted by climate and air pollution in a way that is significant to their health. We are sending those notes to our members of Congress. And most importantly, Alice, we are voting. We are voting like never before. And we are looking to see whether or not climate is a part of the platform of the people that we select and ask to be put into office. So we are always there. We are ever present. And one thing that you definitely want to make sure that you do is if you have mamas that are coming and are asking questions, that is definitely a group that you want to address forthright and honestly and quickly, because at the point in time that you see us, it means that there's some action that has not been taken that we want to make sure is taken very quickly. So I will share this with you. I was talking to a group, and I told them, it's like, you know, if you've got a group of kids at your house and they're in the other room and there's a lot of noise, it doesn't really require a mom to go in the room as long as you can hear that they're okay. It's at the point in time that you hear something breaking or that, you know, it gets super quiet. That's when I, as a mother, get up and go into that room to figure out, okay, what's going on, what's happening. And this is the place where, you know, now our moms are getting up and going in the room. It's not that we haven't been there. We haven't been listening. We have been, and we've been very active and very supportive. But when we see that actions are being taken that are in direct conflict with the health and wellness of our children and our families, it requires more action and more activity, and we are encouraging everyone to join alongside us to make sure that our officials are aware that we are watching and we are demanding climate action now, and that 100% clean energy is a great place to start.
Radio EcoShock.
So in November, you delivered a keynote talk at the 2019 Bioneers Conference, and the title was Climate Action is the Social Justice Issue of Our Time. And I took your test. I went on Google and I searched for images of environmentalists, and sure enough, it's a sea of white faces. So how can we fix that? Is it already being fixed? I know you're part of the change.
Absolutely, and we're showing it. And so I'm so glad you went and took the test. And I don't think I'm so glad, though, it still hasn't changed yet. It's going to take some time for us to work on it, but it's about what we see and identify as an environmentalist, and what does an environmentalist look like? And each and every one of your listeners, the fact that they are actually listening right now, they're tuned in, and they're thinking at this very moment, what can I do? They are an environmentalist. You are an environmentalist. And we have to identify ourselves as people who are concerned about climate and concerned about the air we breathe, but also concerned about the sustainability of our families with respect to the earth that we live on. That's what makes us who we are. So we should share that with our networks. We should take pictures of it the same way that we post things on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. We should do that with respect to the issues of climate and environmentalism within our own social networks. So I challenge each and every one of your listeners, and you as well, you know, identify yourself as an environmentalist. Follow us on Facebook. We're at Clean Air Moms, and on Twitter at Clean Air Moms. I'm at Heather McTeer on Twitter. And, you know, shout out to us and say, hey, I'm an environmentalist. This is what I look like. because it's as we see those images of ourselves and identify it with the things that are most important to us, that's how we change those pictures that show up on Google.
Well, some people are hoping Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates will order 100% clean economy. But personally, do you really think a carbon balance could become a reality without addressing fair distribution of wealth?
That is an excellent question. And I think it absolutely has to be addressed. But I also think that we have to look in the future of how we can ensure that communities and people have access to build wealth using and talking about a green economy and sustainability and things like clean energy. So it's the part where we want to talk about how are our children being educated? Are they being given opportunities to get into a clean economy in terms of job creation and really creating wealth and sharing wealth in this space? Are we looking and making sure that there's fair access to people with respect to things like housing? Green gentrification is a very real thing. And that's when you have communities that, let's say, for example, sea level rise has come in and has really decimated a place such that the people who've lived there for years can no longer afford to live there. But we give tax breaks to rich people so that they can come in and buy a vacation home. You know, these are the types of things that I think have to be addressed and have to be addressed in a way that is fair and equitable, but also gives people an opportunity, to create wealth in this new or even not so new economy that we see is green and is sustainable and is resilient, and give communities an opportunity to build. And some of those names that you mentioned, I'm sure, would do well to look at how they could play a very big role in that.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
Well, I want your listeners to be engaged. Call your congressperson if you are in the United States of America and become involved with Moms Clean Air Force. We're online. You can find us on the web at momscleanairforce.org. You can also find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, on LinkedIn. We're social and we are everywhere. And we want to hear from you and know that we are together in this. Ours is a organization that's based purely on the love of our children, love of all children, and making sure that they have an environment that they can live and be proud in.
Well, listeners, I'll toss all those links in my show blog, but you can just go to momscleanairforce.org and connect with Heather McTeer-Tony, the politician, administrator, eco-justice activist. I really admire your work, Heather. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We are totally out of time for Radio EcoShock this week. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.